Before AI can help your business predict demand, accelerate growth, inform decisions, automate tasks, reveal insights, generate content, you have to trust it. Introducing WatsonX Governance, helping you govern any AI as data, models, and policies change so you can scale it responsibly. Let's create AI that begins with trust with WatsonX Governance. Learn more at ibm.com/governance. IBM, let's create.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager. Today, as you could probably tell from the title of this episode, we have, what is an unusual topic. We're going to be talking about penile transplants. And we just wanted to say up front before we, you know, dive into this episode that every time we've posted something about this subject, because there's been a lot of news about it lately, whether it's been to social media or we talked about it on like our live streams or something like that, it often kind of descends into these sort of like adolescent jokes. And, you know, we want to have a sense of humor about this, but at the same time, like doing this research, it really became apparent to us like how traumatizing this is for a lot of people and how important this procedure is. There's some weird science to it, certainly, but there's a lot of people's lives that are affected by this.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about the loss of genitalia, the loss of a sex organ here, and that's a serious matter. And I think our sort of conditioning, certainly in American culture and in Western culture in general, our conditioning to want to laugh, to want to make a joke about it.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess a lot of that is coming from an area of just, you know, you're uncomfortable. What can you do? What's my response? I can make a joke
laugh.
And then I can fill that space.
Yeah. To get rid of your anxiety or something.
Yeah. And that's understandable. For the most part, I feel like everything is on the table when it comes to humor. But in researching this, in talking with our special guest today, it really became apparent that this unwillingness to seriously engage with this issue has actually held back some of the advances that could help people who need it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's a perfect segue into that. We were very lucky to be able to talk with Mary Roach for about half an hour about her upcoming book, Grunt. In particular, there are two chapters in that book that are about penile transplant surgery for soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very real issue for American soldiers coming back from overseas, in particular, who have been damaged by IED explosions. And the military's wing of doctors are trying to figure out what to do with that. And Mary consulted with a lot of those. But then there's also like a good like 10-year history now of the science of penile transplants, for everything from these wounded soldiers to cancer victims. And then also, as we'll talk about in South Africa, there is ritualistic circumcision that leads to penises essentially falling off.
Right. And it's just situations where it's not full on penile transplant. I mean, we're still, you're still dealing with urotrauma. You're dealing with, with plastic surgery to correct injuries to the genitals. And that is, and some of that science actually is what, as we end up discussing, ends up, stemming from, gender reassignment surgeries and advancements that have been made in that area.
Yeah, and so a little bit of clarification too about like the conversation and then the like sort of turn of events since we recorded the conversation. Mary's book was is coming out soon.
It should be out this week. Grunt: The Curious Science of Humans at War.
And we actually interviewed Mary a couple weeks ago in preparation for this, and since then on May 16th, the first U.S. Penile transplant was achieved. And it was announced in the New York Times, I believe.
Yes.
And actually here at How Stuff Works, our colleague Lauren Vogelbaum wrote an article and recorded a video about that. Mm-hmm. By the time you're hearing this episode, that may be like 2 or 3 week old news. But when we recorded the interview with Mary, it actually hadn't been announced yet.
Right.
So we were focusing primarily on the research and transplants that had been done in China and South Africa, as well as what Mary had experienced in her research with military medicine.
Right. And some of the pending advancements there, like some of the procedures they're working up to.
Yep.
So, yeah, just keep that timeline in mind as you listen to the interview. And, you know, nothing's actually broken in the interview. Just keep in mind when it was recorded.
So we're going to play the interview now and let you hear our conversation with Mary about this fascinating topic. And then when we come back after that, Robert and I are going to go over the brief history and the science of what's going on here with penile transplants.
Well, first of all, thanks for taking the time out of your day to chat with us here. We've really been enjoying reading Grunt, and in the past, I've been a big fan of. I think I've read all of your previous books: Stiff, Spook, Bonk, Gulp, Packing for Mars. So anytime a Mary Roach book comes out, we get excited.
There should be some kind of special, I don't know, bracelet or medal or something that you get if you've read all of them. Very few people have read all of them. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you. With this particular book, I guess the place I want to start is I was particularly interested in the two chapters concerning urotrauma, genital reconstruction surgery, and genital transplants. Because I mean, there's the morbidity and the squeamishness of the topic, but it ultimately provides some powerful insights into the place where science and to a certain extent the war machine itself has to try and stitch everything back together again, both physically and psychologically. Was this a challenging subject matter to undertake?
It was, yeah, for just the reasons that you've just mentioned. It's a sensitive topic. And I'm not known as a sensitive writer, if you're familiar with my book. But it's, I think that because it is sensitive, people shy away from it. And I feel like it's important to talk about it. And so do the people who do the work, because somebody's sexual health and sex life and relationships are in the balance. And that's, you know, that's important stuff. It's important to get veterans, wounded warriors, whatever you want to call them, you know, mobile and walking and able to take care of day-to-day activities and be back on their feet. But sex is important too. And a substantial number of these men sustain injuries that do go up that high. I mean, it's a fraction of them, but still enough that it's important to talk about it.
Hey, Mary, this is Christian Sager, the co-host of the show. To piggyback off of what Robert was just saying, I'm particularly interested here in the cultural and identity connections that you remarked on regarding penis reconstruction. And I'd like to know, you know, from the research and from the people you talk to, how much of the repair part is actually psychological? In particular, I'm thinking of the example you gave of men who are worried about having to sit down to urinate.
Yeah, there is a cultural, what you're talking about is a urethrostomy. I believe I'm saying it right, wherein if it's one option, if rebuilding the urethra isn't possible or doesn't work, you can take what remains of the urethra and make an opening in the perineum.
Okay.
Perineum. However you pronounce it. And then the person would sit down to urinate, you know, as a woman does. And I asked when I was in the operating room, I asked both the surgeons there, like, how much of a big deal is this? And one of them said, well, you know, when you're talking about you've lost one part of one leg and, you know, part of one hand, and, you know, this is not a big deal. The other surgeon looked at me and said, it's huge.
Yeah.
So there's a difference of opinion there. But, yeah, obviously it's, I think it's, it, and then she went on to say that she'd been at a urological conference in Europe. It was a world urology conference, and it was very cultural. She said the Italian surgeons were like, are you kidding me? No. You know, that seemed to be, you know, an affront to masculinity. Other cultures were, you know, seemed like less of a big deal. So, you know, as a woman, it's hard for me. That's an interesting thing. You know, there are sometimes, you know, every now and then I met men who are like, yeah, I sit down in the toilet because, you know, it keeps the carpet cleaner, you know, or my wife likes me too. And,
right.
and then there's other men who are like, you sit down on the toilet to pee. So I think it's both cultural and personal.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting topic.
So they're incorporating therapy into this then as well, I would assume?
Therapy is an area, sexual health and intimacy counseling is an area that I think the government would do well to dedicate more funding to. At the time I was at Walter Reed, there was not a full-time staff person doing just that.
Wow.
You know, there's a sense that you know, we only have so much money to go around, and this, you know, sex is it's lifestyle. This is just lifestyle, you know, that this is not going to be a priority for our taxpayer dollars. And there are people at Walter Reed who work with these patients who feel like that this is really important. Like, yeah, it's important that they walk, but it's also important that they be able to have a sexual relationship that isn't fraught, and that, you know, and that one, you know, once you come out of these operations and you, you know, there's just a lot of things to adjust to, and you know, how do you use this thing now that it's been reconstructed, or, you know, whatever's been done. I mean, and it's not just with reconstruction and transplants, it's also there's a lot of heavy medication that goes on, especially in the early months after an injury. There's nerve stabilizers and antidepressants and pain meds, all of which can affect a man's ability to get an erection or to keep an erection. And that's, you know, that's also should be part of the counseling. And there are people there who do it, but there need to be more of them.
Yeah. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit here because you connected right to another thing I wanted to ask about, which is this idea that sex isn't as valued financially as walking, for instance. And so I'm curious, from your experience researching this book, do you think the fear of just sex talk in general is preventing us from making strides in health sciences?
Yeah. Well, yes. I think that part of it, I mean, the woman that I spoke to, Christine Delorier, who runs the Walter Reed, it's a sexual health and intimacy working group, and it's something she does on her own time. There's about 50 people who get together and share resources and who've been working in this area. And that was what she said to me. She said, this isn't just a budget issue. This is the government not wanting to embrace sex, and not just out of prudishness. I think just as it's out of a sense of, you know, we must spend taxpayer dollars in, you know, the way that taxpayers want us to. Mm-hmm. And sex is perceived as certainly in certain segments of the population, you know, that's not perceived as a worthy expense, you know, it's considered, you know, lower priority.
Okay.
And yeah, I think it is in some way tied in with kind of a, yeah, not a prudishness, but a, you know, it, it, to be spending taxpayer dollars promoting sexual pleasure. You know, it's treacherous grounds, you know, in terms of getting negative media attention or what have you. But it's also, you know, I should also say the number of, I mean, if you look at the number of veterans whose injuries have left them in need of surgery or infertile or what have you, it's a small percentage because most of the injury is in the lower part of the body. It's the foot and the calf and, you know, below the knee. The higher up you go, the less frequent these injuries are. So it's something like 300 genital urogenital, however you want to term it, injuries for something like 150,000 amputations or it's 300 genital urological patients for every 18,000 limb amputees. So it's a lower priority in that sense. And, you know, that's when you're looking at a budget and where to spend the money, that's also part of it. So it's not just squeamishness regarding sex, but I do think that probably plays a factor. Yes.
But as you point out in the book, and this I thought was a really important fact, was just our medical technology has reached the point where more soldiers are surviving the sort of injuries that would in previous decades would have just killed them outright, but now they're surviving with more grievous grievous injuries. Correct?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. The IEDs have gotten larger, so the injuries are going higher up the limb and to the extent where they're affecting the genitals. And that used to be a fatal, and you know, that size of an explosion, it used to be a fatal injury for the most part. That, you know, if you're hitting the level of someone's hips, you're also going to be damaging organs. And so that's a very serious injury. And yes, these patients are now surviving more than they used to. So not only are the injuries, the explosions are getting bigger, but also the ability to keep these folks alive has advanced a lot. So yeah, there are more people surviving to need this kind of surgery and counseling.
So Mary, I'm curious, in the conversations you had with medical professionals about this, how much did they acknowledge the contributions of phalloplasty from the transgender community as contributing to their work?
The very first conversation I had with someone at, it was a meeting I had at USIS, the Uniform Services, University of Health Sciences. And that first person that I spoke to, that's what he said. Some of the, you know, that these are techniques that are stemming from work, from transgender work. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I mean, that is what has pushed the advances in building a penis from various other pieces of anatomy. That's where the demand has been. You know, I mean, it started out with war injuries way, way back. But the very early on, one of the first, you know, I think one of the first cosmetic surgeons who started, I think, doing, you know, rebuilding noses, et cetera. I think one of those was the very first transgender surgery.
Okay. You spend a lot of time with Dr. Richard J. Reddit at Johns Hopkins discussing the continued efforts to conduct the first successful penis transplant in the United States. You know, where are we currently in that process?
Yeah, right now, as of last week, I checked in with him, and there's a recipient that's been identified and they're trying to find a suitable match because it's a, you know, in addition to all the other things that you look for with an organ, organ transplant, in this case, there's skin color. And I mean, that's the case. It's similar to a, you know, like a hand transplant,
right,
or a face transplant. But anyway, they're trying to identify a donor. And I'm not sure how much of it is also the discomfort that the family might have. That I don't know. I don't know why things are why it's been slow to happen.
Because as you point out in the book, the first procedure of this sort took place in Guangzhou, China, back in 2006.
Yes.
And of course, that as you point out, that did not exactly that was not a successful surgery in the long run. this early attempt at it, though, do you think that speaks to anything culturally about a more openness to engage with the sexual questions involved here, or is it just more eagerness to carry out the endeavor?
I think probably more the latter. I think probably more eagerness to plunge ahead and be the first. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in this case, it was, they claimed it was a psychological issue. Two weeks later, they removed it.
Huh.
After having transplanted it. They removed it, and they cited a severe psychological problem, but they didn't elaborate at all, and I wasn't able to get in touch with. They didn't respond to emails, so I don't know. I don't know exactly. There was some necrosis.
Okay.
There was some, you know, and they didn't attach all of the same. I believe that the cavernosal artery. There's an artery that the U.S. surgeons are planning to hook up that I believe that they didn't. So there was in the China operation, but a lot of it is speculation because there hasn't been a lot of open communication between the Chinese surgeons and the U.S. I mean, I wasn't able to get a lot of details about that procedure, only that what is in the paper, which is that there was some psychological distress and it was removed. And it looked like the U.S. surgeons told me that from looking at the photographs, it looked like there was some necrosis, some tissue that was not being receiving blood and getting oxygenated, and that may have contributed as well. But you're asking, why did they go ahead so quickly? And I think that just may be a desire to go ahead, give it a whirl, and be a little less cautious and mm-hmm. a little less inclined to work out all the details. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, I hesitate to call this a lighter note, but Robert and I were both very interested in how erectile tissue can be constructed from the sinuses and also from mouth tissue. Can you speak to that a little bit more? Like, why is it so good for reconstructive penile surgery?
The cheek, yeah, but for rebuilding a urethra or part of a urethra, and this is, of course, a tube that is transporting liquid, the inside of the cheek is good because it's used to moisture. It doesn't deteriorate in moisture. It doesn't break down. It's evolved to be wet all the time. And if you just use skin, you can end up with, infection and fistulas, which is when infection kind of eats through, to the outside and you have sort of a tube going off where you don't want it to. The other thing, you want a patch of tissue that for the penis or the urethra, you don't want hair growing on it. For the urethra, you don't want hair because there's minerals in urine which can collect on and build up on the strands of hair, and that can cause problems. You get little calcifications, little stones, basically. So the cheek is advantageous in two ways. It's used to moisture and it's hairless. You know, for rebuilding a penis, they tend to use, you know, the underside of the arm doesn't have hair. Also, the behind the ear is another, that little strip there, that is a little hairless stretch.
Okay.
And in that case, just you don't want hair growing on your penis, probably.
Right.
I mean, I can't speak.
You would assume, yeah.
As well as you said. Yeah. So anyway, that's why those particular patches of tissue are selected. Yeah.
In reading you some of your past books, I've often found this pattern where there'll be like a section of one book, and then in retrospect, I sort of look back and see like, oh, well, that's maybe where she got the idea for the following book. So I have to ask, when did you decide that Grunt was your next book? And if we look back into previous books, is there a particular chapter in a previous book that basically gave birth to this volume?
No, you'd have to look into the pages of Smithsonian Magazine, and you even then would never be able to tell, because it was a story that had to do with the world's hottest chili peppers, which are grown in Nagaland in India. And while I was reporting that piece, somebody told me that the Indian Defense Ministry had basically weaponized this chili pepper and made a kind of tear gas or mace with this sort of a nature zone tear gas. So I felt like I needed to report on that. I went over to the neighboring state of Assam, India, and went to this lab. And while I was there, there were a number of projects going on that struck me as kind of fascinating and esoteric. There was a leech repellent project going on. And I remember that was the moment where I thought, oh, military science. There's this whole world out there of things that have nothing to do with building better weapons. It's a whole world of the kind of stuff I like to report on. There's a lot of biology and human-related science that goes on, in the name of keeping people alive, which is, I also like that it was kind of counterintuitive for a military book. It's not really about, so much of what you see is about the technology of weaponry and bombs and high-tech lasers and drones, et cetera. So the human side of it seemed, it seemed to fit in it. But anyway, it didn't grow out of anything in any of the earlier books. It was from a story I was doing in between books.
Yeah, that's interesting for us because we just maybe a month or two ago did an episode on the history of the weaponization of animals for military purposes. So it was really nice to see in your book, like, the flip side to it, where it was more of the, like, healing function that all this, DOD research goes towards.
So did you cover I saw something about owls. Did you cover that one where the Coast Guard wanted to use owls?
No.
Oh, no.
Look for, that was, anyway, but that's not weaponization. That was more like, almost more like a cadaver rescue dog. It was using owls to.
Well, we've talked about going back and doing a second episode where we talk about the use of animals in more like spying, surveillance, other uses aside from just killing people.
I think the craziest one we got into was the bat bomb. Did you ever hear about that during World War II?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. I almost put it in the book, but I had to remind myself it was a little off topic for me. Bat bombs were amazing.
It's totally insane.
So how does science, and sort of generally speaking, and, in your experience, how does science that orbits military endeavors, and not necessarily the weaponized stuff, but the stuff you cover in this book, how does it differ from other areas of science and scientific research and inquiry?
It's an interesting mix because there's a whole world of science that gets funded through DARPA, which is very, it's with an eye to the future. And then, like, for example, there'd be, and I didn't cover a lot of DARPA stuff, but I was fascinated by it because it was, it'd be some idea of like, what's a way to make, soldiers, more effective and better at what they do? Wouldn't it be great if there were a way where they could not be sleep deprived so they could sleep but have, one eye open, like be partially looking out for things, but still sleep and not get sleep deprived. And so they were looking at, animals, marine mammals and also some birds that have, that are awake in one hemisphere and asleep in the other. Like there are geese and ducks that can, they'll sleep in a group and the ones on the perimeter will sleep, but also be watching out for predators. And so there's some, biologists or zoologists who've gotten funded by DARPA to study unihemispheric sleep. So and you'll look at this paper and they'll think, why is DARPA funding? Like, oh, okay.
Right.
They're looking forward to the future. Like, how can we make this kind of invincible modulated soldier? Like what could we do to the soldier to make him or her more efficient, more awake, just less of a human and more of a fighting machine. So there's that very strange world, which I didn't spend much time in. I just sort of would come across the papers and go, whoa, really? Surgically installed gills? Really? So that's that sort of futuristic, surreal stuff. And then there's just a tremendous amount of work that kind of goes on under the radar. That's just, like the Naval Submarine Medical Research Lab, which is just, looking at sleep deprivation and, air levels and the various things that people deal with when they're out on a submarine and how to sort of make that existence better, more efficient, healthier, et cetera. So, but there's like that work goes on and has gone on. It just is not, it's kind of, invisible. I mean, it's not, it just doesn't get a lot of attention. And it's, you know, it was heartening to me to see that that's there and that the people that are doing it are very committed and dedicated and caring. You know, the ultimate reason some of this work is being done, you know, when you get right down to it, it's like how to make soldiers better at what they do and keep them alive so they can keep being soldiers, which is less sort of heartwarming. Mm-hmm. But you take it down to the level of the actual scientists, and they're really caring people who are very dedicated to the lives of men and women who are serving in the military. And that's so it was, anyway, I don't know if that answered your question.
No, that's exactly what I was wondering. Just sort of what the energy of the research is like as opposed to like non-military research. I think that answers the question perfectly. I can only imagine you're getting a lot of interview questions about the Eurotrauma and the penile transplant sections of the book as we ask you. And again, I want to stress that I thought you handled it just perfectly with, utilizing the expected Mary Roach voice, but also, you know, handling some potentially delicate subject matter. But can you tell our listeners and readers about something that you explored in the book that's getting less coverage that maybe you wish more interviewers were asking you about?
Well, I'm actually, you know, the book, since I'm talking to you a month before the book is out, so you are really among the first folks that I've spoken to. I've done some Q&As, and to be honest, this is the first time where I've talked in much detail about it, partly because there just haven't been many interviews yet. And it'll be interesting to see whether this is something people focus on or whether they'd rather leave it alone, because it is, you know, it is sensitive, and it's, there's a level of discomfort with the conversation and with, I guess, how listeners, readers, whatever will react to it. And, so I don't know whether that will be discussed. I would think it would be discussed a lot, but we'll see.
It's hard to imagine it coming up on the talk shows, I guess, like the late night talk shows.
Yeah, depending on who the host is. or I was thinking more like, you know, CBS Sunday Morning or you know, the morning. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The morning mainstream TV, you know, while people are having their breakfast.
Yeah, we really gravitated toward that section. I think it felt like it fit the voice of the show. The whole book did, but this in particular, we were like, that is something we can make a whole episode around.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I mean, there's two chapters in the book, and I had originally planned one, and then I heard about the transplant that the folks at Johns Hopkins were working towards, and then I obviously wanted to cover that. I mean, partly because I'm Mary Roach and that's the kind of thing I covered, but also just how could I not want to cover that? It's just really interesting because it's terra incognito for the transplant world. Well, you know, the first face transplant was tremendously compelling to people because mm-hmm. it's, you know, we've left behind the world of, you know, organs they're hidden. You don't really look at somebody and you think, okay, they've got a new liver. That's great. But that doesn't have the same, there's not a psychological component that's as kind of immediately fascinating.
Yeah. I feel like a lot of this research too, just like strays right alongside like some borderline science fiction pop culture stuff too. You know, like when we're talking about these sleep experiments, thinking about, Robert and I have done episodes in the past about, like people speculating about all these myths about theoretical Russian military sleep experiments, you know, and then like, of course, you know, you just mentioned the face transplant thing and it brings to mind what's that 90s movie Face Off where they swap faces, you know, and this is stuff that people have kind of
Nicolas Cage, right?
Yeah. And people have been thinking about it in sort of silly terms for a while, but this has some very serious real world applications.
Yeah, and the fact that the immunosuppressive regimens have made tremendous strides, and so now you can do something like a faith transplant, which because it wasn't a matter of life and death, people sort of shied away from it because the burden of the drugs that you take to suppress the immune system so it doesn't reject the tissue, that seemed, you know, it was questionably ethical. Do you put somebody, you know, should you put someone through the risks and inconveniences and problems of this very heavy immunosuppressive regimen just for a face, when it's not a matter of life and death? And now that they've, you know, with marrow infusion and other advances in immunosuppression, now it's that's kind of falling away, and it's they're transplanting whole arms, they're transplanting faces, and, you know, now penises, and probably at some point legs, although legs are problematic for various reasons, and because they're also at the same time making great strides with prosthetics.
Yeah.
You know, with prosthetic. Yeah. So, you definitely want to, a leg transplant is not going to be the best option for a very long time, I think. So, but then, yeah, this is the guy in Italy who's talking about a whole body transplant, or what is sort of commonly talked about in the press as a head transplant, but really the head is the person. The transplantation is the whole body of the brain dead person. So, and there's some guy in Italy, I don't know how much of that is bluster and how much of that is real, but he's talking about, oh yeah, I've got a patient and I'm ready to go.
Yeah.
Which I can't even imagine, because that's, there's so many unknowns with that and so many potential problems. I don't know. And I haven't spoken to him, but anyway, this whole Frankenstein science fiction realm is rapidly coming to be not science fiction, and it's fascinating.
Now, in all of your books, I always enjoy the footnotes so much, because there are always these little nuggets of fascination that kind of spring off from the main material. And in this one, there were several great ones, but the 1885 rabbit eye transplant by one Dr. H. Bradford, that one really floored me. Were you able to learn much about this?
Just what was in the paper. You know, I couldn't interview him. He's long gone. But there were so many things that fascinated me about that. First of all, the fact that rabbit eyes are very similar to human eyes. If you go on the internet, you can sort of verify this. And I don't really recommend that, because when you do the search, this weird thing comes up about a guy who was selling a box of rabbit heads. Anyway, for purposes, I don't know why, but they seem like he was offering a pretty good deal on those rabbit heads. But
you know, they don't come cheap, those rabbit heads.
No. And then I was like, well, is somebody transplanting eyeballs? Why would you want these rabbit heads? What are you doing with them? And he was like, make me an offer. But anyway, see, this is what happens when I go off on these tangents. But there was some guy who, he was a sailor, I think, he worked on ships, and he, for some reason, that was, they were saying, well, for that reason, a glass eye won't work. I guess it was an occupational issue. So they wanted to do something that wouldn't break when you were hit in the face or something. Huh. And then I thought, well, yeah, pirates have eye patches, so maybe there is a high level of ocular injury on ships. I don't know why. Hmm. Anyway, that was what the reason they gave for why they were going to do this. And of course, I should point out to listeners, the eye, this is just, it was cosmetic. It wasn't going to be hooked up and you would be able to, the person couldn't see, because there's never been a successful eye transplant, because hooking up the eye, it's a much more complicated, it's instead of like hooking up a telephone cable, you know, I'm talking about the nerves here, you're hooking up, you know, a complicated computer system, and the body doesn't know how to regrow and reattach and make it all work again. So there hasn't been an eye transplant other than this cosmetic 19, early 1900s. I don't have the date handy.
But it said 1885.
Yeah, I think 1885 was what I
Yeah, yeah. Mm. Yeah, yeah. So other than the guy who tried to do it for transparent reasons, yeah, there hasn't. There's not any, but nobody else is transplanting eyes, rabbit or
or otherwise.
Or otherwise.
All right. Well, you know, those were our main questions for you here today. Again, thank you for taking time out of your day to chat with us. Greatly enjoyed the book, and we certainly encourage all of our listeners to go and pick it up. When this episode comes out, it should be available in all the physical and digital ways that one normally acquires a good book.
Well, thanks. Thanks so much for having me on this program.
Thanks once again to Mary Roach. Again, the book is Grunt, The Curious Science of Humans at War. Thanks to Mary for coming on the show and chatting with us. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, Christian and I are going to discuss the topic further. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Is getting gas at Shell burning a hole in your wallet? What if I told you you can easily earn cash back while you fill up? Introducing Drop, the app that turns every fill-up into a reward. With Drop, you'll earn points to get free gift cards every time you fill up your tank. Download Drop and use code DROP88 to instantly receive $5 in points to jumpstart your savings journey. Don't miss out on turning your gas expenses into something rewarding.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So let's back up a little bit. We've had myths and legends of penis loss and probably replacement as well that go back pretty far. It's the sort of thing that's likely lost in the mist of history. I mean, the myths of are full of castration and penectomy accounts, with a primordial castration of the god Uranus being one of the big ones. And I've read various European tales that have involved witches stealing men's penises, mm-hmm. sometimes hiding them away in trees, and then sometimes the men are able to steal the penises back and they are somehow magically reattached to the body. So,
and this is probably like a legend that is deeply seated in psychological fears of, you know, as we're going to talk about, that there's like a real deep psychological cultural connection to your genitals.
Yeah.
Of course. But, something like that seems like, you know, it's sort of pre-Lorena Bobbitt style, like fear of the woman stealing manliness.
Yeah, and even then there's like a sense of humor and uneasiness, unwillingness to like confront the horror and terror of it, and therefore wrapping it then in the in something a little more whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as just simply reattaching a penis that has been cut from the body, penis reattachment surgery has been around for a little while. In fact, Dr. Surasak Mungsambat of Thailand actually became something of an expert in it during the 90s due to an upswing in such attacks on philandering men by their wives.
Mm.
Transplanting one's own member back is challenging enough, especially if said member has been fed to a duck.
Wow.
Which was apparently the practice at the time.
I wonder why in particular a duck rather than any other animal. That's something we should look into.
I would be curious to see what the sort of cultural implications of that, or is it just that ducks are around?
Maybe they're just plentiful.
Yeah.
Well, if you out there know, let us know about that.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it's a worse fate than a fish. I'm not sure.
Who knows? Yeah.
But certainly it's one thing it's complicated enough involving microsurgery.
Yeah.
To put a penis back onto an individual, but then to transplant another's member, that's a more complicated scenario.
So before we get into the like real nitty gritty specifics about how these penile transplants work, I think it's worth doing just like a brief overview of organ transplantation in general, because a lot of the same stuff applies here. So, to start with, researchers originally had success in the early 20th century with transplanting organs in animals, but not in humans. And they had a lot of failures. They could not make it work until the 1950s, when the first kidney transplant started to work out. And this is important because it was saving lives. In these instances, these are organs that people need to live, right? Kidneys, hearts. And so they need these transplants, and oftentimes, even today, still don't get them because of the availability. And that's something that we're going to talk about as well. But genitals were kind of off the table. Nobody had been able to pull that one off. And the problem here is that the demand for organs, with all of the diseases that are affecting us as human beings, way outweighs the supply of the actual organs. There's just not enough.
Right.
Donors can wait for years. Sometimes they die while they're waiting. And we're talking about thousands of people here. This isn't penile transplants, but just organ transplants in general. And even though here in the U.S., people in general favor organ donation, right? Like, if you walk up to most people on the street and ask them, I'm sure they would say, yeah, sure, I would, you know, after I pass away, give my organs to science or something like that, right? Or to somebody who needs them. But actually, only a small percentage of people do this. They actually go through the procedure of filling out the paperwork for it. And this is how serious it is. 16 potential recipients die every single day from something that's totally curable if they had transplants.
Wow.
And then we're also obviously looking into artificial organs. You're hearing a lot about this lately, not just in bioengineering, but then also with like the advent of 3D printing, what people can do with that.
Right, the creation of the necessary scaffolding and then the growing of tissue over that to create a suitable replacement organ.
Yeah. So in the cases of organs that are super sensitive, like your heart, your lungs, and other sensitive organs, transplantation is actually like the last resort. Like, that's the last thing that they want to do. But here's the process of how this works, and it's essentially the same for penile transplants. A patient finds a willing donor. Usually it's a friend or a family member, but what they're looking for is a match, somebody that can go directly into surgery. And a small number of these transplants come from general donors, of course, people who you know, have filled out their organ donor cards or whatnot. But many of these have to come from dead donors. And oftentimes, we're actually talking about brain-dead donors, not physically dead donors.
That's kind of the ideal, if you want to say, situation,
yeah,
because the body is preserved with life, but there is no more mental capacity in the creature.
Exactly. And it's incredibly complex going through the process of getting permission to get an organ from somebody who's technically still alive, but who's brain dead legally.
Right.
So it's so complex. In fact, like, we don't have time to go into it on this episode and also, you know, give you the interview that we did with Mary. But if you really want to know more about it, I recommend going and checking out the article that's at howstuffworks.com about organ transplants in general. There's some good information there. The actual transplantation itself involves a huge team of surgeons. Obviously, there's a hospital involved, and they all have to assess the patient's attitude, their psychological condition, and especially their history with drugs, cigarette, and alcohol use, because that can complicate things as well. Compatibility, in particular, requires everything from your physical tissues and blood samples being able to match to how long the recipient has actually been waiting for this, right? So when it's a go, you move quickly. You really hurry the patient into surgery, and then a whole nother team goes and gets the organ from the donor. Now, here's a disturbing little tidbit note that you can stash away. Overseas organs often come from executed prisoners, most notably in China. And there's an indication that because there are people paying for these organs, it's actually accelerated the execution schedules in these countries in order to meet demand. So that's pretty disturbing. Post-operation recovery usually involves a lot of medication and a lot of follow-up hospital visits to make sure that everything's healed correctly. This is going to pretty much last for the rest of your life. And the reason why is because your immune system is going to see this new organ as foreign cells, and it's going to try to attack it. So to minimize this, like I said before, you try to match the blood and tissue types, but also the body's just naturally going to reject it unless you have like an identical twin hanging around and they're willing to give up their organs to you. So there's three kinds of rejection. There's hyperacute rejection, and this is when, like, the blood type just doesn't match up at all. The antibodies react, and really, like, this is a worst-case scenario because the recipient is going to die on the operating table. Acute reaction, or rejection, rather, is what we see most often. And this is when you have a normal immune response. It starts a few days after the transplant, and basically our immune system it needs to be suppressed by medications so that we can go ahead with the transplant. The unfortunate side effect is it makes us susceptible to infection and disease, right? So sometimes they're trying out this new thing where they sometimes also take bone marrow transplants to produce white blood cells inside the recipient's body, hoping that their immune system will sort of be tricked into recognizing the new organ. The last kind of rejection is a chronic rejection, and this is a gradual thing that lasts over the course of months or years. You may not find out until many years after the transplant that that it didn't actually hold. And one note that I'd like to point out here too is that these immunosuppressive drugs that we give the patients, they also have adverse effects over long term, including cancer and kidney damage. So in some situations, the benefits may not outweigh the risks involved here. So let's get to penises, shall we? Until recently, and like I'm talking like 10 years recently, the only treatment for men was to construct a penis from the flesh of their thigh or forearm skin.
And so basic plastic surgery reconstruction.
Yeah, and so you take that skin, you add a penile prosthetic, and it's got malleable or inflatable rods in it that make it semi-rigid. Then you add a saline pump to this that fills it up, right? Like acting like the blood filling up the tissue of a penis. And this has been around since the 70s, this practice. This is a direct quote from one of the articles that we researched for this, about this procedure. It said, "The aesthetics were crude and the penetration is awkward."
So now, that can be said about most people's first experience is sexually.
That's true too. But, yeah. See, we do have a sense of humor.
Yeah, yeah. And, and I think it's also worth noting that it's look at imagining this scenario here, and certainly you can look up images and more technical documents on all this. It's easy to say, well, that sounds crude, and certainly that's no replacement for the tissue situation. But that is still pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
That we were able to accomplish this. This is still quite a surgical feat.
Yeah. it gets it back to what we were talking about in our cyborgs episode, mm-hmm. like the things that we're able to accomplish, what makes us human, what makes us the machine, the cyborg nature of humanity. Yeah.
So I don't want to slight that procedure at all, because that is an amazing feat.
And then here's the other thing that made any kind of penile transplants really difficult and still does. So I talked earlier about how just getting organs in general is difficult, right? Getting a penis donor is even more difficult. The organ banks that accept other internal organs, they don't even have like a field on their form for penises, right?
Right.
And so they don't usually request these. It has to be done separately. In fact, in South Africa, families often flat out refuse. And this is going to be important because the first penile transplant was in South Africa. But there's such an emotional, cultural gravity to a request like that, that most people just say, no, I will not give you, you know, my dead family member's penis. And in the case of the people who did the first penile transplant in South Africa, they actually had to come up with a way to work around it, where they started constructing faux penises for the dead, from the donor's skin to preserve their dignity, in their graves, and subsequently still be able to use the penis and give it to a living recipient.
Huh. Wow. That is crazy. You know, in Grunt, Mary Roach's book, she points out that the cadavers that were being used in some of the, not even actual transplant procedures, but essentially rehearsals, for an upcoming transplant procedure. Like, those are situations where somebody's body was donated to science and they're not about to, you know, necessarily share the exact details of how that body was used.
Yeah, totally.
You know, in part because of the complexities of our psychological attachments to these various parts.
Yeah, who wants to know about like how their loved one was carved up and maybe mistakes were made on them or whatever? But the benefit is that it led to the successes that we're going to talk about next, and some of the failures.
So, let's go back to a case that Mary Roach discussed in the interview. This was 2006, Guangzhou General Hospital in Guangzhou, China. You had a 44-year-old man who had lost his penis in a, quote, an unfortunate traumatic accident. That's about all we know. Mm-hmm. One of the, is we've already touched on in the interview, this case, there's some material that is not as directly related to the reader, that is maybe, some of it might be lost in translation. Some of it is just maybe not provided.
There are a lot of things about this particular case, and it's been 10 years, that are still vague to this day. And when we talked to Mary, we sort of mentioned that, right? Like, I remember saying to her, you know, what was actually up with that? And she said, as far as she could tell, it was necrosis, but we'll get there.
So the lead surgeon on this one was one Dr. Hu Wei Li.
Ever tried to tackle a home improvement project without making 10 trips to Home Depot? What if I told you there's a way to earn cash back while you shop? Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards by shopping in-store or online at Home Depot and tons of other stores. Download the Drop app today and use code DROP33 to get an instant $5 in points. That's Drop, your go-to for shopping rewards.
This is Amy Brown from Four Things with Amy Brown. Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways that healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear.
We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
And so from what we know, the parents of a brain-dead man in his 20s agreed to donate their son's penis to this man who was damaged in this unfortunate traumatic accident. Now, the way that they did it in this Chinese procedure was they warmed up the donor's penis with an infrared lamp post-operation. And this was supposed to increase the metabolic requirements of the organ instead of increasing the blood supply. Now, other doctors that have been interviewed about this particular procedure, they have said things along the lines of they think that what happened here and why it didn't work out was there was inadequate psychological workup. So like with a lot of the procedures that we talk about on this show that are semi-experimental, like, say, using MDMA to help with PTSD, right?
Right.
It requires therapy as well. It's psychological and physical. And
it's not like just you're not doing body work in a car here.
Yeah, exactly. Now, in the particular case for the biological surgery here with this Chinese case, they could only use the local nerve structures because the donor's blood vessels had actually been obliterated. And they rerouted a blood vessel from his lower abdomen to his perineum to connect it to this new penis. Then they connected the blood vessels and dorsal nerves and then the urethra for urination and the corpus cavernosum for erections. Now, according to The Guardian, they thought, okay, everything was a success. After about 10 days, he had a rich blood supply and could urinate normally. But then the recipient and his wife came back in 2 weeks after the surgery and requested that it be removed. And as we talked about with Mary, nobody really knows the answer here, but we think that it's likely due to psychological issues surrounding the necrosis of the tissue involved.
Yeah, and of course you can't help but wonder, like, to what extent was this, how much of this was a failed reattachment surgery?
Right.
And then to what extent is it more psychological? Like, is the version that everyone gets, is it leaning one way or another? Did they decide to lean away from blaming the science?
Yeah.
You know, what kind of...
how was it portrayed in the media?
Exactly.
And like you said earlier, how much is lost in translation when we bring it over to English-speaking media? So there's a lot of confusion around this case, but from what we know, it was considered a, quote, failure because the man asked it to be removed.
Right. And we shouldn't discount the psychological issues at all.
Absolutely.
Because psychological issues involving transplants are not unheard of. The world's first hand transplant recipient, a New Zealander by the name of Clint Hallam, he stopped taking his immune suppression drugs by choice, and then later requested that the hand be amputated. So, and this is often brought up as an example of, well, they essentially tackled the problem like auto work, and they didn't take into account that you have to have all of this additional psychological support as well.
Yeah, this is incredibly gruesome stuff when you get down to the nitty gritty of it too. Like, this is the kind of stuff that would make up like a Tales from the Crypt style story or something like that. Like, mm-hmm. like he has a dead man's hand and you know what I mean?
Like, it lends itself very well to paranoid thinking and to doubt. And I can't help but wonder, too, like in the, especially these earlier cases, to what extent was the, were they straight, like 100% straight with expectations for the recipient? They're like, hey, this is, this you aren't going to be 100% new. This is not going to be a, you know, a 1-2-3 fix it scenario.
Right. It's not like you, and as we'll talk about, you don't just walk out of there and you've got a fully functioning penis. It takes like weeks to months to years to try to get everything working properly. And in fact, in the South African case, they were surprised at how quickly things became functional.
Well, let's look at that, the South African case. This is 2015. And we're, this is taking place at the Tigerberg Hospital in Cape Town, South Africa. A 21-year-old penile amputee who lost his penis in a botched circumcision. And this is apparently pretty common. Dozens, some say hundreds of boys are maimed or die each year during traditional initiation ceremonies. So these are not, these are not infant, circumcisions. These are coming of age circumcisions.
Yeah. He was 18 when this happened. And these ritual circumcisions are, basically, the way that it goes is they're so tightly wrapped that it causes necrosis in the penis, but, you know, without it even being detached. So his penis had to be amputated. This is particularly common in South Africa's, I believe this is Xhosa speaking region. It's X-H-O-S-A. I'm not quite sure how to pronounce that, but let's say it's Xhosa, speaking region of the Eastern Cape. And it, so it's a rite of passage for young men. They actually attend circumcision school and they're instructed in family values and sexual education there. There's also high prices that are charged for this procedure. So basically they take the penis, they wrap it at its base to stem the flow of blood up to the foreskin, right? Some men actually die because they won't go to a hospital because they're afraid of being ostracized after revealing that their gangrenous penis has fallen off. So there's such a strong psychological cultural connection to this thing that it's leading to people dying. So yeah, so South Africa seems like an ideal place to start, getting a prep team ready to go for the first penile transplant.
And the lead surgeon here was one Professor André van der Merwe.
So when the recipient recovered, he actually had to come back in, and drain a hematoma and repair a small fistula in the urethra. And now here's the thing. They expected that it was going to take 2 years for him to be fully functional. It only took 3.5 months. And the surgery itself, it took 4 years of clinical and ethical therapeutic preparation. Mm-hmm. They had to work with cadavers in practice, as we talked about earlier. It was really difficult to find penile donors, as we talked about earlier. They were trying to overcome this by doing the whole procedure that I talked about where they build these fake penises. So this team is not only trying to come up with a way to help these victims of this botched ritual circumcision, but then they also have to come up with a way to somehow please the families of the donors. And as of the last time this was reported, the hospital had 9 more candidates in wait. But the good news is the recipient, the patient, last June, it was reported that his girlfriend was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
So fully functioning penis, apparently.
It would seem, yeah. I wonder if this case, if it also helped that the recipient was so young, just by virtue of, you know, the cause of the accident.
Whereas in the recent case, the American case, he was far, not he's not old, but he was older than this guy. He's 64 years old.
Right. All right, so let's get to this most recent case. When we're looking at May 8th through 8th and the 9th, 2016.
Mm-hmm. Weeks ago.
Yeah, just weeks ago. It took place at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Thomas Manning, a 64-year-old bank courier from Halifax, Massachusetts, penis was removed because of cancer.
Now, this is, you know, most recent, and the New York Times and then also The Atlantic did really great write-ups on this. So a lot of our information is from here. Man, I wish we could get Mary on the phone again and talk about this. I'm sure she was pretty interested in it as well. It took 30 healthcare workers in total to perform this operation. There were 3 years of preparation. Again, all the practicing on cadavers. Now, Manning only found out about the fact that he had this rare cancer after he had an accident at work. When he went into the doctor, they said, whoa, there's this, you know, abnormal growth on your penis. And they realized that it was so cancerous that it had to be amputated. Now, it only took him 2 weeks, though, to find a donor who matched his blood and tissue type. So that works out pretty well.
Yeah.
Now, the surgery here in the U.S. is estimated to cost somewhere between $50,000 and $75,000, but the hospitals involved are paying for the procedures while the doctors are donating their time. So everything, as far as we know with this, is so far so good, right? In their official statement, they said that the penis has regular blood flow, no signs of infection or rejection. They hope that in a few weeks he'll achieve normal urination, so probably around right now, I would imagine. They say they already have another patient waiting. This guy, his penis was destroyed by burns in a car accident. Mm. Ultimately, their goal is to help combat veterans, like we talked about with Mary, and other cancer patients and accident victims. They're, in fact, hoping to train their techniques to military surgeons, because this is, like we talked about with Mary, so common with IED victims.
Yes, I mean, all this is very much taking on the front lines of the surgical frontier. That's why doctors are donating their times. That's why hospitals are paying the bills here. And then hopefully as these techniques are perfected, yeah, they will be passed down, and others can start utilizing these techniques around the world.
Now, there's one thing that I want to add to this. We talked a little bit about it with Mary. In the press release about this U.S. penile transplant, they specifically said this will not be offered to transgender people for now. Now, I want to just touch on this a little bit, because as we were reading Mary's book, mm-hmm. obviously it was apparent that the science behind gender reassignment surgery has been used as sort of like a building block to get to where we are with these penile transplants.
Yeah.
When I was 21, I read Kate Bornstein's Gender Outlaw, and it specifically describes the female to male gender reassignment surgery. And I immediately thought, when we were doing this research, well, it's clear that, you know, there's a foundation there. And it seems to be the secret that no one's really talking about. I mean, clearly in China and South Africa, and then in this most recent U.S. case, it's not in the public press releases, right? But I think that it's fair to say that these medical teams did get some help, at least, or some foundational work from the efforts that were done there.
Yeah, yeah, because the field of gender reassignment surgery definitely had an impact on our ability to treat urotrauma, wounds to the genital area. And, of course, all this ends up playing directly into our ability to graft a donor penis onto a recipient.
Yeah.
But I do agree with you. It seems weird that that these contributions have not been highlighted more. And there's a just continued unwillingness, perhaps, to discuss who should be able to receive these procedures.
Yeah, and given the controversy right now, especially like it's a hot button issue with transgender rights and bathrooms in North Carolina, you know, these hospitals, they want to retain their funding. I get it. Like,
yeah,
it's a PR move, but I think, you know, for us covering this, it's only fair to be honest and say, you know, it seems like there was some foundational work there. Now, there's also another topic that we don't have time for today, but maybe we'll be able to come back to in the future, which is the fact that there are actually artificially grown genitals that are being used and prepared for potential transplantation, both penises and vaginas. The vaginas actually successful and have been so for years.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't really have time to dive into the science on that today. So if this is, you know, something that's interesting to you listeners and you want to hear more about it, let us know. And Robert and I can come back and maybe we'll do something on artificially grown organs and transplantation.
Grown genitals. Who doesn't want to hear an episode on that?
Yeah.
Also, we're going to be talking futuristically, so I feel like maybe that we'll be able to actually work in a little more humor as we distance it from some of the, you know, the real life and often grim circumstances that require these procedures to begin with.
Yeah, especially, man, let me tell you what they do to rabbits for this. Next time.
Next time.
Next time on Stuff to Blow Your Mind.
The things they do to rabbits.
Yep.
All right. Well, hey, in the meantime, check out the landing page for this episode on stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find links out to some of the articles we mentioned here, links out to Mary's book, and you'll also find all the podcast episodes. You'll find blog posts, links to our social media accounts, such as Facebook and Twitter. We are Blow the Mind on both of those. We're also on Tumblr. We're also on Instagram.
Yeah, and if you want to write us directly and tell us what you know about penile transplants or artificially grown organs or whatever, write us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Tired of routine Walgreens trips? Get rewarded for shopping with Drop. With Drop, you can earn free gift cards on groceries, gas, and more. Download Drop now and use code DROP55 to get $5 in points. Join Drop today.
Top Thrill 2 is like no other course. Two 420-foot vertical speedways, three launches.
All right, let's talk strategy.
Copy that, driver. Go for maximum acceleration off the start.
Roger that.
You've got a short straightaway to push from 0 to 74 on the first vertical speedway.
And what about the rollback?
Rollback will set you up for an explosive reverse climb 420 feet in the sky so you reach 0 Gs in total weightlessness.
420 feet of straight-up speed. Let's get it.
Top Thrill 2, the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch strata coaster. Get your tickets at cedarpoint.com.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.